Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your more than what they are of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Been over, then I murder. Pop gunner if you want your burger. Oh, baby, you be lying in your verses. I be hearing say you buying them purses. I can't even lie, you ain't my type. You ain't even know that fine in person. I can guarantee you if you my kind, she got every bag you can imagine. Big house, I can really be bragging. 100,000 in my mouth like what's that? And not the big cheap tea that's embarrassing. We're just going to get right into it this week. Joe is here.
I'm back.
Joe's back.
Back.
Yes, emphatically. Big back. First of all, hi.
Hello.
I have missed you.
I've missed you too. You know what I've really missed? Pedro.
Aww.
True story. True story. I haven't had to go through that withdrawal, but you have.
I wish we were in the studio, though.
That's true. Joe, you may not know this, but I have turned my home office into podcast studio. We do a segment called JC Cribs every week where I grab something that is littering my personal space and turn it into content. So at the end of this episode, we will be sure to do that. And obviously that would, speaking of endlessly renewable resources, that is a bit that will never die. I wanted to talk about Lil Baby this week for a couple reasons. One, obviously this has been a huge year for him. You did, from what I can tell, his only print interview. There were some radio interviews around album release. I think you did the only print interview. It's been a very big year. My turn. The deluxe edition just went back to number one on the Billboard album chart. But also, Lil Baby stepped up to the political and cultural moment and put out a song recently called The Bigger Picture, one of many, many protest or protest theme songs that have come out in the last few weeks. This is definitely one of the best of that group. And I think it's very telling that he's deep enough into his career. This is someone who was almost like ambivalent about rapping 2 to 3 years ago, but he's come far enough that not only is he committed to the art and the career of rapping, but also to make a statement in this way. Joe, since you have spent time with him now on at least a couple of occasions, right? In this story, and then also maybe 2 or 3 years ago when you were writing about QC, the label.
Yeah, and a handful of times in between then. Baby will eventually be a big, if not the main, character in the book that I'm writing about rap music in Atlanta. And one of the reasons for that is that I basically have gotten to see his whole career pretty up close. Yeah, I met him about almost 3 years ago at this point. He was putting out, I think, maybe his third mixtape, but those first five came within less than a year, I think. So he was putting out a ton of music. I think I did pretty much his first ever interview, which he, speaking of ambivalence, didn't want to be doing. He was forced to be there by his managers and label owners, but we sort of got on pretty well. And I've spent a lot of time with him in the months and years since then, as well as with his close friends. And I've had a very pleasant 3+ hour brunch with his mother in Atlanta about a year ago. So it's been very interesting to watch him become this sort of leading figure in rap music and popular culture, a position that I think maybe he wasn't initially interested in, but was sort of hoisted upon him. And now he's taking ownership of.
Yeah, let's talk about the early days, because I think anybody who lived through hip hop, especially in the 2000s, going into the early 2010s, you remember this kind of refrain of like, I'm not a rapper.
Right.
I'm not a rapper. I rap. I make records. I may even be a star, but I'm not a rapper, which kind of, you know, revealed some like ambient anxiety about what it meant to essentially cross over into being a full-time entertainer and what it meant about who you were and what you were made of, in essence. Lil Baby in 2017, 2018 seemed to be the sort of pure embodiment of that sentiment based on the interview that you did with him and some of the other stuff that he was doing that time. It seems that he had a tremendous amount of skepticism about becoming essentially what he is now. What do you think was behind that skepticism at the time?
Most literally, he was not a rapper, like, until he got out of prison. He spent 2 years in prison in 2015-ish to 2017. And even before that, he had spent a lot of time around what was then the beginnings of Quality Control. So that's Coach K and P in Atlanta. and the Migos essentially were their major artists at the time. And he was known for being around the studio and gambling, basically. He's somebody that P and Coach knew from the street, and he was known as a dice player. He was known as a big time weed dealer in the West End around where he grew up. And he sort of had this mythic figure on the streets of Atlanta that I think you saw in, when you talk about Not a Rapper, you know, one of the main guys in history is someone like Young Jeezy. And that, I think, crucially, was also a Coach K project. So from talking to Coach and P about it over the years, they knew that Baby was a star. They knew he carried himself like a star. They knew people in his neighborhood treated him like a star. And they always told him, you got to rap, you got to rap, you got to rap. And he just was not interested. He was, you know, from all accounts, making a lot of money in the street and just was a fan of rap music, but had never saw himself doing that. He just wasn't interested. And then he goes to jail on this these run together drug and gun charges that he'd been collecting through his teenage years. He's eventually, he gets in a big fight in prison. He's sent to a maximum security prison, and he has a kid while he's in jail and decides, like, I cannot do this ever again. So when he gets out, you know, a lot of the people he'd been hanging around had turned to rap in the meantime. You know, he's went to the same high school as Young Thug. He knew Gunna from way back. A lot of these guys had become rappers in the meantime. And he finally sort of took the label and these guys around him up on their offer to help him be a rapper because he was sick of going to prison, basically.
Also, this is around the time when I think QC is understanding how streaming is changing hip hop consumption. And totally. Part of what they're doing is essentially feeding the system at a rapid rate. You know, if this was the 90s and you had a label and you had a star or a star group like Migos, you'd work them and you'd work them really hard, and that would buy you the right, in essence, to then be like, I'm going to put on the next guy, or I'm going to put on a compilation of 10 other people and see if anybody sticks. And these were incremental steps that took a long time. You couldn't do it directly on the back, one after the next, after the next. Streaming doesn't function like that. Streaming, you can fill the playlists and you can literally saturate and flood Spotify, Apple Music with an infinite amount of content. So QC and Lil Baby is essentially one part of that QC plan during that era. It ends up being the most successful part, but it was also just one part of the plan.
Totally. I mean, I think it's crucial to remember, like, he got out of prison right around the time that Bad and Bougie made the Migos click the second time around. Because the first time around, the industry wasn't ready for what they were doing, which was putting out dozens of mixtapes and songs all the time. And then, you know, their first album flops because streaming wasn't a thing yet, basically. And then they're sort of right in the middle of when it catches. And then Lil Baby's there to, like, grab the baton, basically, and just sort of flood the world with music from then until now. Before My Turn came out this year, he had gone basically the whole of 2019 without putting out an album. And yet he still has more projects in the last 3 years than probably anyone, especially in the mainstream.
Yeah, I mean, 2017, 2018 are huge years for him. Obviously, the Harder Than Hard tape is really, really good. You know, I'm partial to the Lil Baby and Gunna album, Drip Harder, although I listened to it again a couple days ago and I don't like it quite as much as I remember liking it, but I do still a lot of really good stuff on there.
I think it was a little bit rushed because Sold Out Dates had leaked. It was such a big hit, and then Drip Too Hard obviously came out and became this massive hit, and then both of these guys were like getting so popular at the time, they just threw together a tape. That's why you have some solo songs on there, some group songs, you know, you have the Drake record that didn't really go anywhere.
That's like the unheard Drake collaboration.
Yeah, I think it was just, yeah, they just had to like strike while it was super hot. And that's why you get a little bit of an unfinished feel on that tape, I think.
So let's just listen to Drip Too Hard because it's a sight of pure joy.
Drip too hard, don't stand too close. You gon' fuck around and drown. Off this way, doing all these shows. I've been on the road, I don't care where I go, long as I get paid. Bad little vibe, she been on my mind. Soon as I get back, she can slay. Do this all the time, this ain't no surprise. Every other night, another movie can make.
So 2018 is a big year, and then Lil Baby basically retreats from the spotlight in 2019. Was that a strategic retreat in your understanding, or was that circumstantial? What was behind going away after being so intensely present?
You know, I talked to him about this in February, last time I saw him, right before coronavirus. And, you know, he was sort of like, I looked up and I realized a year had gone by. I think what was happening was he was becoming so in demand that he was doing like 4 shows a weekend, basically, and playing everywhere, stacking money. And then he became like the hottest, most in demand rapper for a feature. And I think, yeah, he was just doing so many features, playing so many shows, doing appearances, that he was basically just like saving money and running on momentum and just like didn't get a chance to put out much music. You know, he put out maybe a few scattered singles throughout that year. He started being on soundtracks. I think it was just like when you graduate to the sort of A-list of hip hop, you get all these other opportunities. And then he sort of had to take a moment to retrench and come back with a giant body of music, which obviously he did.
So my turn is both a big record spatially. It's 20 songs. It's also his most advanced lyrical record. I'm not totally sure it's his best album, but it's the album that you would expect of someone who is trying to show off more sides of himself.
Yeah, it's not tight, but it's the most versatile. It has the most big records on it, and I think probably the highs are the highest.
We should talk for a minute about Emotionally Scarred. This is a song that's kind of taken on its own life. Oh, I hit the mic. Sorry. This is a song that's kind of taken on its own life, getting remixed by other artists. There's an NLE Choppa version of it that's really good. Let's listen to a touch of Emotionally Scarred.
A love letter came through the mail. It said, I miss you. I ripped it up and flushed with the tissue. Try to forget you. I ain't got nothing against you. We human. We all got issues. But I'm tired of being tired of being tired. That part of me done died. I see it, then I don't act like I'm blind. I'm confident it won't be one of mine. No emotions come in line, so I tell the truth all the time. Ain't got no sympathy for no fool. I admit that I'm rich and I'm lit. Jumping up on stages, I get 200 occasions. Bro, ain't really the game, or we make the shit they trap down.
Here's Lil Baby pushing vulnerability, pushing emotions front and center. In one of the interviews, one of the radio interviews that he did, I can't remember if it's the Power 105 or the Hot 97 one, but he talked about essentially writing his life. And he's like, I try not to do bad things because then bad things end up in the music. And if I'm feeling a certain way, there's kind of no way that that's not going to end up in song. I was really struck by that because I think a lot of people say that, but then they don't actually make records like Emotionally Scarred.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think what you saw on this album, what you see in this song, and then what's happened since with the bigger picture is really just people sort of like awakening to the fact that like this is a really thoughtful, introspective dude. I think he gets associated with Gucci, who he knows from way back. He gets associated with Thug, who's one of his mentors, with Gunna and the Migos, who he came up under and alongside. But he's not really like those guys. He's a lyrical rapper. He's not really a traditional trap dude. And he's not really, you know, a quote unquote mumble rapper. He's like Boosie. He, you know, his favorite rapper is Starlito. You know what I mean?
Oh, is that true? Starlito? Wow.
Who also put out a great protest song today called Paternity Leave. I don't know if you heard it.
I haven't heard it yet, no.
Push me to my limit like a foreign when you rent it. I ain't going cause they know I was born, not sworn in it. Not to mention that I'm still war torn and tormented. Recorded this just a vent, I've been chilling out for a minute. Not an activist, I'm a realist, could care less if you don't feel it.
Yeah, he sort of like came out of mini retirement to drop a song. And, you know, I think he had Starlito on 2 of those early tape. So I think this version of him has been around. A lot of people first heard Lil Baby from the Drake song, Yes Indeed, right? He sort of has this catchy, playful line, the wah, wah, wah part that sort of became his first like meme. But Emotionally Scarred is actually more like another one of his huge songs, Freestyle, from the Too Hard tape, which became, I think, probably even bigger than Yes Indeed, especially in the South and in Atlanta. And that one is the same thing as Emotionally Scarred in that it's just like, you know, it's just 4 minutes of rapping and a lot of flexing, but also a lot of emotion. And I think he was always that artist who's just like getting recognized as such now.
2 things. One, I do think that kind of saturation approach to streaming doesn't totally serve an artist like Lil Baby, who I think benefits from a little bit closer attention, not necessarily getting clustered between four or five similar sounding songs or similarly structured songs. He also, from a pure flow pattern perspective, he does teeter kind of right on the edge of lethargy.
Yes.
On the one side, obviously lethargy can be a conscious choice, a sort of a symbolic approach to rapping, but also if that's where you're on the edge of, and then you have a 20 or a 25 song project, that can be a challenge to sort of sift through. And I do think sometimes his most intense or vibrant songs would benefit from more distance around them, more space, a tighter edit.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that comes into play along with just sheer volume is he has a very distinct Atlanta accent. He raps in this way where he's both extremely deliberate about the way he's pronouncing his words and making rhymes and flows, but is also can sound like there's marbles in his mouth. And I think that that's like a big barrier to entry for a lot of people, and they don't, similar to Boosie in that way, like people don't automatically think of him as a lyrical rapper because it doesn't have the crispness that a guy like Kendrick or whatever has in his delivery. And that's a thing that Southern rappers have faced since
the 90s. Yeah, of course.
Which is like, if you have a drawl, people assume that you're stupid.
Right. But there was a kind of recurring thread in the coverage of the protest song. And you saw this in Charles Holmes' Rolling Stone piece and also Alphonse at Pitchfork. Basically, the tone of the coverage being like, Lil Baby's been good. You guys are just late to the party. Which is, again, if you were paying attention, like you say, to Freestyle, if you're paying attention to Emotionally Scarred, if you're paying attention, there's another song on My Turn that I really love called Hurtin'. If you're paying attention to Hurtin', you know that Lil Baby is already there. But there is a perception that he's not. And then, like I said, in some of this coverage, it seems to be in reaction to the perception. And that's something that I think there's still a tug of war ongoing about.
Totally. He's also a very autobiographical rapper in a way that I think like a lot of the Atlanta guys of the last 5 to 10 years are not necessarily known for that. He doesn't really do punchlines. You know what I mean? He's not a bar by bar rapper. He sort of storytells in his verses, and there's something sort of stream of consciousness about it. And I think that comes from the way he and all of his contemporaries record, which is one bar at a time improvisation. But he raps still as if he's writing. There's this one song, Best of Me, from Too Hard, I think. And the first verse is about getting into a shootout with his friends and some other guys and thinking they like shot a child in the crossfire, and about like coming home and flipping on the news. And it's like, you know, it's a full short story in 16 bars or whatever. And I think that's not something people expect from this world at this moment.
Okay, so let's listen to that verse from Best of Me.
Remember that shootout we had at time, and we thought a kid died. Only thing I know is when we pulled up, everybody hopped out fine. I remember on the way back, everybody in the car quiet. I'm just knowing everybody thinking, we just pulled a homicide. TV on the news at the spot, trying to see what they say got shot. I'm the first one stood up, told my brothers all I got. Know somebody seen us, they gon' talk to phone room. I thought it was about it, thinking, damn, we just caught a body. Hoping everybody keep us out.
To your point, you want to locate Lil Baby sort of in two parallel traditions. On the one hand, a storytelling tradition, whether it's Boosie, Starlito, even Scarface, if you want to take it all the way back from a Southern storyteller perspective. But also in terms of what he's doing with cadences and what he's doing with patterns, obviously he's very influenced by Thug and Thug adjacent and Thug indebted rappers. Right. So I think if you're approaching him purely from a sonic perspective, there are some choices that he's making that sound like the smoothing out and potentially even the popification of Young Thug's most eccentric choices. And I feel like since the kind of peak Thug period of 5 years ago or a little bit more, there's always been the sense of, someone's going to figure that out. Like someone's going to take this kind of EKG approach to melody and figure out the pop melodic pockets in it. And Lil Baby, I think maybe in 2017, wasn't clear that that's what he was doing, but more and more in 2020, it seems like that's part of what he's bringing to hip hop right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think he definitely started same as Gunna, as one of these guys who were considered, you know, and now you have maybe Lil Keed in that mix of guys who learned to rap from Young Thug, which in Baby's case is true, literally. He told me in that very first interview, like, you know, Thug was one of my first champions. He used to try to pay me to stay in the studio and off the block, basically. And so he took from that molds very, very obviously, and sounds a lot like him at certain moments in songs when that they do together. You know, the one on My Turn, they come in and out of each other sounding almost like the same artist. But I think he's also sort of sublimated some of his melodic choices. It's still there, and it makes the really wordy, rappy songs catchy because he has these little hooks everywhere. But he's also done less singing, I think, in the last year or so in favor of writing these really long verses. And I think that sort of separated him from Thug, because Thug is so non sequitur in his rapping.
Purely in the moment. Purely in the moment.
Yeah. So I feel like they've sort of split off, and he's sort of like differentiated himself from Thug and Gunna in that sense, especially because Gunna doesn't really toy with his flow that much. He pretty much stays in one pocket.
Speaking of Baby and Gunna, did you see the video of them at Icebox together recently?
No, I haven't seen that one. What is that?
Icebox is like a jewelry store, and they have these videos on YouTube, right? When just for the people who may not know, sure. You know, when rappers come to shop there, they do these little, I'm sure they get some kind of discount for doing it, but basically it's just like following them around the store, trying on rings or whatever. And the thing that I was kind of most touched by in this video, like, they're barely looking at the camera. They're really barely acknowledging the camera there. It really is just like watching two friends hang out. It just happens to be at a store where like necklaces cost $50,000 or whatever. Right. It's like if they followed me and you around, you know what right. I mean? Like, it's just very, it's very casual. You know what I mean? It's very casual. There's a lot of shorthand. There's a lot of like knowing. There's conversations that's happening that where there's no conversation happening. And you can tell that they very much grew up side by side and are extremely comfortable with each other.
Yeah, I mean, that was
nice to watch.
He's super low key. He's very shy. You know, I've like been around when Gunna FaceTimes him or whatever. And they're like, they're not rap friends. They're like, they're real friends, you know? And I think that he keeps a tight circle in that way. And it's meaningful to him to like keep those guys around and not run in sort of celebrity circles.
One thing that came up in that video that I feel like I saw him talk about in another interview, he has a label, an imprint called 4PF, Four Pockets Full, as I think right. what it stands for. In that video, he talks about buying chains for a dozen or so people. And in an interview that I saw him give, he talked about, I think it was Rilo Rodriguez, who's one of the artists on the imprint, talking about basically trying to educate him on the right way to take his advance money. And almost in the opposite of how we have come to understand, like, oh, rappers are starting labels and ripping off other rappers. He seemed to be talking about it in like very much the opposite way of just like, you think you want your money this way, but actually that's the worst way for you to get it. Why don't I tell you the best way for you to get it? So he seems very invested in not just absorbing from whether it's Coach K&P or Thug, but also passing on. He wants to be kind of like a vector for change.
Yeah, it's really interesting how quickly he's become the sun in his own little solar system, signing artists, but not in this way that we're used to, where like that person just gets turned into a member of the entourage and doesn't really ever put out any music. Like when you think of someone like Rilo Rodriguez, he comes from a similar tradition of very Southern introspection, you know, and then he took on 42 Doug, who's this Detroit rapper. They have that record We Paid that I feel like is maybe the hottest song of the summer that's not Pop Smoke, especially in the South. Like I was in Jackson Heights the other day and it was all Pop Smoke and then a Lil Baby song, like every three songs. And if you go to Atlanta at any point in the last 2+ years, it's 90% Lil Baby with like maybe a Future or a Keed or a Thug song stuck in the mix.
Legacy rapper Future.
Yeah, exactly. But I just think, yeah, he's
your grandfather's favorite rapper, Future.
Yeah, but he's sort of turned into this CEO simultaneously. And that's something we're used to seeing rappers present as, but not actually get off the ground in a talent spotting and then putting on, like you're talking about, this sort of passing on of wisdom.
Have you watched the Power 105, the Breakfast Club interview, and the Hot 97 interview?
Yeah, the most recent ones.
So when we talk about embodying the sort of character of the rapper, right? The way he's presenting, I'm pretty sure, and I don't want to get it wrong, I think this is in the Hot 97 interview, where he's got many, many chains and literally a ring on every finger. And then sitting there talking about it in this kind of very metal way of becoming this thing and then being the thing while talking about how it's a choice to become the thing. You see it with Kanye, or you've seen it a little bit with Drake over the years, but there isn't always that kind of total admission that, yes, I'm in essence dressing up to be this. I'm in essence putting this role on. Now, that's not to say it's not valid or real, but it is a choice. And I just thought the sort of levels of the dialogue in that conversation were fascinating to see.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to give away all my little anecdotes from my book, but I have so many that I feel comfortable going with this one. So, you know, he and his friend and the engineer who was there that night talked to me about like the first time they went in a real studio to record. And they knew that they would have to make a video for Instagram, right? Basically to be like, Baby's rapping now. Like everyone in Atlanta knew who Baby was, but they didn't think of him as a rapper. So as they were sort of preparing for his first real night in the studio, they brought $300,000 or $500,000 cash to like make the video, you know? And they all just talk about it as if it's like the most obvious thing in the world, which is like, duh, the first time you make your in studio video, like you better have all this cash on you. And you can go back and find it on his Instagram and you see automatically Gucci and Thug in the comments sort of fighting over who's going to sign him.
Oh,
and
man.
He just came in with this level of presentation, which I think comes from having spent so many years around rap, but not actually considering himself or even wanting to be a rapper. So by the time he got there, he just knew exactly the steps he needed to take to present professionally.
And then now that he's done that, he is also doubling down on the actual rapping on top of all that. I mean, the Flex freestyle, not to be all like New York rap about it, but like the Flex freestyle is very, very, very good. Sometimes you watch Flex freestyles and he's just like, ooh, me, you know, he's just doing all this stuff. And you can tell even Flex is kind of like caught off guard. Like, yeah. It's like, he's not even doing the things that he does in the most rote way to, oh, I just trashed my mic.
You just got to flex on that mic.
I did flex on the mic. Pedro, is it okay? Does it sound okay now?
Yeah, it sounds okay. But it just dawned on me that every show we did without Joe, you didn't hit your microphone once. And now like three times today.
And now I'm back.
It's Joe's fault.
I'm back.
Oh, wow. That really warms my heart.
So anyway, as I was saying, he's not even doing the rote stuff that he does when a rapper is, you know, when he's trying to like gas people up, he has like a sort of a go-to set of things. He's not even doing those things. He's just sort of like, oh, you know, it's like he's been like stunned into a little bit of awed silence.
I mean, if anyone still has like a sort of bias against Southern rappers, it's Flex, you know? So to see him impressed Ebro, like and that. Right, and Ebro.
Let's listen to this Flex freestyle.
Me getting rich ain't no coincidence. You with the message, but I had to lead a bitch. I get checks and they be confidential. Yeah, my number's crazy. I don't need a bitch. Lamborghini with the top off, trying to do the dash for feeding ticket. Fuck around and got my gang cracking. Different labels want to have a meeting with me.
In addition to the Flex freestyle, I think the Fire in the Booth freestyle was also similarly just like jaw dropping in the way that like you can see this guy has been getting better like right before your eyes.
And it's interesting because we usually think as people get bigger and more popular and more widely known that they're actually sandpapering down their sharpest parts, their most eccentric parts, their most vivid parts. And Lil Baby is very much taking the opposite direction, which is he's getting better. He's getting more widely known and he's getting more vivid. He's getting more colorful, more intense.
I almost think that he has this barrier to the pop mainstream because of what we talked about the authenticity of his Atlanta accent and his sort of drawl prevents him a little bit from being on, like, you know, a Ariana Grande song.
He could do what Thug did, which is, you know, I mean, I don't love all of Thug's pop crossover records, but he did kind of figure out some version of rapping on the one, in essence.
Yeah, no, don't get me wrong. I think it'll happen because he's just so big and such a streaming monster. But I think it's actually been beneficial to him that that avenue wasn't available to him for the first few years of his career.
Because it just allowed him to just develop in his own without considering how other people might want him to change or just himself.
Yeah, and he does these things, you know, he like switches up his flow in weird ways. He does like these run-on sentences where he doesn't hit the rhyme you expect him to. You know, sometimes he's a little offbeat. Like, he has all these sort of like bespoke qualities that I think have really endeared people to him, but have kept him from like the box that even someone like DaBaby jumped so quick into.
With that in mind, we should talk a little bit about the bigger picture. So obviously, over the last few weeks, we've had any number of protest songs coming from all directions and songs influenced by the recent conversation about race and racial justice in America. Lil Baby jumping in on that is important for a variety of reasons, but it's important because he is literally the hottest rapper. Maybe DaBaby is hotter, but right there, he's number one or number two, right at the center of the hip-hop conversation. So if people are going to be open to hearing a song on this subject matter that would come from the hottest rapper in the game, this is who it would come from. So it's powerful on its own as a song. It's also powerful using that platform for this purpose.
Yeah, and I think it's uniquely suited to his skill set and his interests, which are, again, coming from a place of ambivalence, you know, coming from a place of like, I'm figuring this out alongside you. Like, I'm just a regular guy. I've now been bestowed all this power and I'm trying to figure out what to do with it. And you really hear that in this song. You know, he's coloring outside the lines. He's feeling it out as he goes. He's not making any like overarching statements. You know, he's not J. Cole-ing it. He's not trying to intellectualize it. He's just saying like, this is what I've seen. This is what I feel. This is how what I'm seeing now is changing how I feel.
It's also good to be in a moment where, you know, Lil Baby has a song. DaBaby put out a remix of Rockstar, which is his record with Roddy Ricch, which is the number one song in the country. There's a Black Lives Matter remix of that song. It's a great moment to see the most poignant, popular rappers of the moment take on this subject matter. And as you say, for Lil Baby, who has been growing in real time, who is already autobiographically inclined, that he's taking this in and then recycling it through the music. It's just great to see. And the video is very cool too. Shot at an actual protest. I mean, it's tough to say for 100% sure, but it seems like it was shot at an actual protest.
No, yeah, he went out with a local politician to sort of see what was happening in the streets in Atlanta. And yeah, I guess had probably made that song ahead of time. So sort of did a 2-for-1 trip where he got to see what was going on the ground and also make a pretty arresting music video.
Let's actually listen to some of the bigger picture, which has just quotable after quotable. So let's get into some of that now.
It's bigger than black and white. It's a problem with the whole way of life. Can't change overnight. But we gotta start somewhere, might as well go ahead, start here. We done had a hell of a year, I'ma make it count why I'm here. God is the only man I fear. It's bigger than black and white. It's a problem with the whole way of life. It can't change overnight. But we gotta start somewhere, might as well go ahead, start here. We done had a hell of a year, I'ma make it count why I'm here. God is the only man I fear.
Before we go, obviously you've been away, you know, you weren't underground, but you were away for a few months.
Some of it I was underground.
Now that you're back, you know, just in the last couple of weeks, you kind of came back right into the moment where the music business is beginning to kind of have this very public reckoning with how it is handled, black artists, black employees, racial equity, so on and so forth. What do you most have your eye on? What are the things that have been most striking to you, especially after being off grid for a couple months as things were starting to kind of unfold? Now that you've came right back into it, what are the things that you're seeing that you're most struck by, either positive or negative?
when I was gone, when I left, and the biggest chunk of my leave was coronavirus. And that was the thing that had totally upended the music industry. And so I thought I'd be coming back to a world in which labels and artists were trying to figure out what to do. You know, they're not going to be able to tour probably for the rest of the year and into 2021. And then the week I returned to work, it gets flipped over even further on its head. I guess the main thing I'm sort of keeping an eye on with the industry now is hoping that they don't use these little anthills to take their eye off of the biggest issues. You know, I think you did this episode last week about the term urban, and I think we've seen a lot of back and forth on whether or not that's the right move. And, you know, you just see labels spending a lot of attention and man hours on what's ultimately a pretty small battle. And I don't want that to distract from these larger questions of, as you say, racial equity, of, you know, contracts that have been unfair for decades, the pilfering of Black art and Black music from communities in need. So I think a lot of these task forces that you're seeing, a lot of these big time donations from labels and streaming services and whatever, like, that's the beginning of the real work. But I don't want us to get too bogged down in like the semantic details of, oh, now this playlist has been given a Black cover for Juneteenth. Like, that's not real change. That's a superficial Band-Aid.
And this is a challenge because it's very, very hard for people who are primarily driven by the profit motive, obviously, as most record labels, generally speaking, are. It's hard for people who are driven by the profit motive to organize themselves around something that is not driven by the profit motive, which is to say justice, fairness, equity, things of that nature. And doing these things that are very much optics focused, like you can change the name of a department, you can print new business cards. That doesn't change how you're doing business. It changes the kind of cover under which you do business, but it doesn't change how you're doing business. And I agree, the sort of tugs of war that you're starting to see, look, optics are important. We talked about it last week. Urban reflects decades and decades and decades of erasure of Black art and identifying music as Black music. So that's very clear. And if we're taking a step away from that and towards more transparency, that's obviously a positive thing. But just simply taking that step does not actually erase the sort of ill that was done as a result of that, and also what was underneath that decision in the first place. So it's my hope to see more serious engagement with that subject matter as well.
Yeah, in some of the industry trades, you've seen a little bit of discussion about going back and trying to right the wrongs that were done in some of these early contracts, whether that includes like basically zeroing out the unrecouped balance so artists can begin receiving their royalties again, basically. And so they're not just going back directly to the label. And then you see something like what Jeff Tweedy proposed yesterday, which is basically for white artists to adjust their contracts moving forward. So, you know, a certain percentage would basically be paid in reparations to Black artists. And, you know, I think these more practical, but also actionable ideas for the long term are what's going to actually change things, but also are much more difficult to enact. And you have to sort of keep the momentum and keep the pressure on to make sure some of these things happen.
And just to tie it back to Lil Baby, you know, what we were talking about before, where he is being very proactive in terms of explaining how the music business works to the artists that he is trying to promote. It happens in a lot of different ways. And him sort of providing that level of understanding and education, it's all part of larger, hopefully, change.
Yeah. And I think when you see these artists willing to jump into the fray of these protests, even when they're not positive what they want to say, that can go wrong, obviously. But it also, I think, keeps the pressure on these labels, these corporations, to know that guys like Lil Baby and DaBaby, the biggest stars you have at the moment, like, this is something they are interested in, fixated on, and dedicated to. And so you better keep them happy, basically.
And I assume they're going to bring that energy to meetings with the labels, not just to put it in songs, but also meetings with labels, conversations with executives, until it's just a normal part of those conversations.
Yeah, you got to spook Lucian Grange and Rob Stringer and these guys into staying the course.
Joe, before I get into JC Cribbs, what's a good old Lil Baby song you'd like to hear
Oh, wow. Look, good old Lil Baby song. Can we play Put a Date on It, the Yo Gotti feature?
Wow. Wow.
That was a big hit on Atlanta radio.
Let's go. Put a Date on It, Lil Baby, Yo Gotti, Joe Coscarelli.
Set coming in and the money on fold. Gotta put a stamp on it. Yeah, hit a plate. Scrape it off the plate. Hey, gotta put the camp on it. Y'all always talking that tough. Put a date on it. Everybody sitting at the table around here. Yeah, there's a lot of place on it. Running through the money and keep calling. Hold up. She gonna have to wait on it.
For JC Cribs this week. So I think I mentioned this last week, but I wrote, or maybe a couple weeks ago, I wrote in the wake of the passing of Andre Harrell about a very important Jodeci live performance, which is the MTV Unplugged cover of Stevie Wonder's Lately. If you haven't watched it, I mean, literally just stop listening to me right now. Go to YouTube, watch it. It will undo you and remake you. Get involved with it. After I wrote that piece, I was thinking a lot about early Jodeci and them coming out of the church tradition and gospel music. And I had always kind of faintly known that the Haley brothers were part of a family gospel outfit. I had kind of never really walked down that road. And I was like, let me Google around and see what I could find. And I found Lil Cedric and the Haley Singers was the name of the family gospel group. They had three albums. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to get these albums because I want to listen to them. And so I tracked them down, shout out Discogs, it's three albums called Jesus Saves, God's Blessings, and I'm All Right Now. I've had a chance to listen to some of them, some really very strong music on them. Lil said, that's Casey. You can hear the beginnings of his voice that you will know and be very familiar with from Jodeci songs. It's very striking. He's young. He's definitely, like, I would say, 12, 13 here. So it's not a fully formed voice, but it's just really intriguing to hear that tone and texture, both as it's being developed and also applied to an entirely different style of music. And you can hear that fervency, that faithfulness, that ultimately that anointing that you hear in Jodeci, you hear where it comes from. So we're going to listen to a song from Lil Cedric and the Haley Singers as we go out. That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Shout out to Joe. We're happy to have him back. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com, or get involved with the Facebook group. There's a lot of action going on there. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content. That's Spotify, Apple Podcasts, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. And we're going to take you out this week, as promised. It's Lil Cedric and the Haley Singers. Here's a song called Trust in God. 'Cause I trust in God.